Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Caitlin Doty, author and mortician, and we're talking about her latest book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big questions from tiny mortals about death. Caitlin, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
It's good to be back.
I love your books, and this one's really good. Where did these questions come from? Are these just common questions you've heard all the time?
No, well, you know, I tried to pick ones that were a little more specific because I think that they add the flair of what makes kids' questions unique. So they started, the title of the book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs, is from a young boy in Australia. I was doing an event, he raised his hand, he asked that question, and I just fell in love. Like, what a brilliant, blunt question that adults think about and have existential fears around.
I have to say, Caitlin, I posted the title of your book on my Facebook site, and everybody started like freaking out because they wanted to know. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to answer that question today because I want people to buy your book. But I will say, Yeah, I'm going to be coy about it.
Okay, all right. Will they?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I have three cats at home. They're indoor cats. And I have a snake. The snake I'm not worried about, except that I'm going to have to leave it to somebody when I die. It's an ancient snake. It's 45 years old.
Wow.
But I am concerned about my cats because my cats are screwy enough and weird enough to do something like that on purpose, even if they didn't need to.
You just see them eyeing you from underneath the couch.
Yeah, they do that anyway. Like, they're always plotting something. But it's funny how people have a weird existential dread about their pets.
They do. And so when this kid asked the question, it wasn't like a general question about, you know, what about a postmortem predation, which is the technical term for animals eating you after you die. But you wanted to know, will my cat eat my eyeballs? And that's sort of when I fell in love with the idea of kids' questions, specifically that are things that adults never really got the chance to learn. And so that's what kicked it off. And since then, I've been collecting questions from real-life children.
You know, you talk about adults never getting a chance to learn. I think these are all questions everybody has, but there is no way to learn about them because nobody talks about any of this stuff at all.
Exactly. And we have a low death literacy in our culture. Basic things like embalming, cremation,
right,
burial, what happens after you die, or just how you die, there's not a lot of information about. And so it's something that most people, I think, on a feeling level are uncomfortable not knowing about, but yet we don't. You know, there's a lot of things that in our culture that we say, okay, we have to learn about it. We have to make sure we, you know, sexuality. We have to understand that we know as much as possible. And there's been a real renaissance on being informed and why it's so important to be informed on political things, on sexuality-related things. But with death, we just haven't gotten to that place yet where we say, listen, as a culture, it's important and valuable for us to be informed for how we live our lives. And hopefully that's a renaissance we have. I have books like Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs for when it happens.
The other thing is, I think there's a whole other range of questions about death that's beyond your purview. I'm sure people ask about what's going to happen after I die and what's it feel like when you die. And
they do, yeah. And I try not to answer that in this book in particular,
right,
because I want this book to be absolutely for everyone. I want to make sure that the questions that I'm answering are questions that I am the expert on for the most part. Some questions I really had to research and that was fun, but for the most part, the dead body, the corpse in the first couple days after death is what I do and what my job is and what my job's been for years. And so I didn't, you know, if a kid is asking, well, what happens, you know, to your soul when you die? Or if an adult is asking that, I can tell them what I think personally my opinion is, but that's not, you know, that's a conversation that a child should probably be having with their parents, not their weird aunt, Caitlin.
The one who gives you Fruit Loops?
Oh, yeah. I made the joke that I gave a kid Fruit Loops and a framed photo of Prince for their birthday.
That's a great present. I just want to say thank you. That's a great present.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got to start the kid off right.
That's right. Now, let's talk about some of the questions, and I don't want to give away most of the book because they are really interesting. And people should, this is the kind of book you should have in your house because it does answer these basic questions. I think especially if you have a family, this is the kind of thing that's going to come up. Now, I just finished binge watching Battlestar Galactica, the second incarnation of it, and there was a lot of death in space. And they were just launching bodies left and right out of the spaceship. So you have a great chapter on what would happen if you're to die in space. And let's talk about what happens if you're outside your spaceship, your vehicle, your whatever, and you punch a hole in your suit. There's a lot of, right. They show that a lot in movies, but what you're talking about doesn't seem to be what matches up what they show in the films at all.
It's going to be a little more, it's still going to be pretty horrific, and it's definitely going to end in death, but it's going to be a little more contained than our idea of space death. There are sci-fi movies where people, you know, expand until they explode and shatter into a million pieces and, you know, just basically implode right there because of the lack of atmosphere. But really, you're probably going to lose consciousness pretty quickly, you know, in 10 seconds or so. And you're probably not going to have time unless someone's right there with you to get you back in the pressurized environment and to the point that your body is going to expand. It's sort of like a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory situation, not that dramatic, but you will expand and your blood may even start to borderline boil, and that causes internal organs to rupture and similar to the bends that you get when you're in deep, deep water and come up too quickly.
Wow.
And yeah, and that will cause a pretty quick death, but hopefully a painless one because you will have passed out fairly quickly.
That's part one of the situation. Okay. Now,
and that's actually my and I'm fascinated by that. That was a lot of research that I did to figure out exactly what happened.
Can I ask you how they found out?
I'm interested.
Yeah.
Well, they found out because they put humans and more unfortunate dogs and animals in these chambers, in these chambers and scientific situations, and tested it to see what would happen.
Yes.
Because we've never had this precise type of death in space.
We have had a lot of deaths.
Disasters.
Yeah, we've had a lot of deaths like on launches.
Exactly.
But we've never had anybody up in the space station die yet.
Get punctured and float away into nothingness.
Or just have a heart attack on the station.
Right.
And die.
No one's just died. Which is going to start happening.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same thing. I have a question about dying on a plane. When you have that many people up in the air every day, people are going to die of old age.
I want to talk about that in a second because that was the chapter that most freaked me out. But let's
really?
I want to stick with space. So you're in the space station, you're in Mir or whatever, and somebody dies. The question is, what are you going to do with the body? And that seems to become a problem that people have thought about before. Have they planned for that?
They have thought about it, but NASA won't talk about it.
Huh.
You can't get, it's really hard to get someone to talk to you about it. But there are several options. One would be just try to keep the body cold.
Yeah.
And the coldest place on a shuttle or on the space station would be where the garbage is, because they're trying to have it not rot. They're trying to keep it, you know, from smelling and from contaminants and whatnot, so they keep it very cold. But, you know, is it okay to keep a fallen hero in the garbage area of a plane? Another option, which they probably won't do, but it's what they've been doing to sailors for many hundreds of years, which is the idea of just a burial at sea or a burial at space, so to say.
That's what they did at Battlestar Galactica. They just launched them into space.
There you go. Yeah, launch them into space. They would probably get stuck on an orbit for a while, which means that other space shuttles, you know, you could drive by or fly by and see, you know, old Adam just floating by, which might be a problem until, you know, he eventually perhaps gets cremated in an atmosphere somewhere.
You
and then you have... new technology and ideas, like the idea of essentially freeze drying a body.
Well, this is the body back system. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So this was NASA did do this as kind of a conceptual idea a couple of years ago. And this is a real company that's not legal anywhere yet, but it's out of Sweden called Promessa. And the idea is essentially a freeze drying of the body and then shaking it so the body disintegrates into a kind of powder. And then you could put that, I believe it's something like 30 to 40 pounds of human body powder and now neutralized. And you could put it in a container and hand it to the parents like you would a flag or a box of cremated remains at the end of the process.
Is the amount of body that would be left, I guess by weight I'm talking about, in the body back system the same as if it was cremated, or is it lighter and smaller and more compact if you're cremated?
It is lighter, smaller, more compact when you're cremated. Adult cremated remains are usually 4 to 6 pounds, depending on how much bone you had. So I'm 6'1". I'm a pretty tall woman. So I'd probably have pretty heavy cremated remains. And it doesn't matter how much fat you have on your body, because that burns away as organic material. It just matters how heavy your bones are, because cremated remains are your ground up inorganic skeleton, essentially.
You do a great description of what actually happens when you're cremated. And then people do ask that question. I mean, does a heavier person make more remains? And as you said, it's more to do with the bones and the height than the weight. Now, I have to mention, I went through my first cremation a couple of years ago. I had my mother cremated. And I was unprepared for what the remains would look like, because I was supposed to scatter them. Mm-hmm. And I thought there would literally be ashes. And it's not ashes. It's sort of clay, like light gray clay kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely. And you know, sometimes it sort of depends on what the ashes look like. There are, depending on certain factors and how they're cremated, they can look slightly different. But for the most part, what you're going to get is a light gray, mostly fine kind of sandy material, almost.
Yeah.
But there might be some small chunks of bone, because what happens after the cremation is it's all bone fragments. It's big chunks of skeleton. And in some countries, they just put that into an urn and give it to you. But obviously, you can't scatter that, or you could, but it's much easier if it's ground down to a fine sand-like texture. And so it goes into a machine called the cremulator, which is a big, almost like a crock pot meets blender. And the bones go in there, it whirs around for 20 seconds, and what you have at the end are what you might know as cremated remains or ashes, all uniform and able to be scattered.
Is the name cremulator like a brand name, or is that the actual name of the piece of equipment?
I think it's like Kleenex.
Okay. Like Xerox and Kleenex.
Brand. Yeah, exactly. It was originally the brand name, but has just become the default name for it. That's what I think.
No, and this is actually, I think, outside the purview of your book, but it was interesting. When I had my mother cremated and I wanted to scatter her ashes, here in Massachusetts, you can't do that, except under very specific circumstances. So I had my family funeral home, told me that they would put it in an urn with a really easy screw off on top.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to these two beaches where I wanted to scatter my mother's remains and then pour them into a sand pail. And then when nobody was looking, toss it into the water. But what I was unprepared for is the stuff doesn't dissolve. There was just this perfect white outline of where I throw the stuff in the water. And like, I was like, whoa, it was like one big fingerprint of what I had just done. And so I had to hightail it.
See you. I mean, she did dissolve. She will dissolve, you know.
Okay. I need to know that. Okay.
Minutes. Yeah. 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 Oh yeah. No, it's definitely will dissolve. Definitely will disperse.
But not right away. But not right away.
No. So when you do, so most states, coastal states, requires that you go a certain distance offshore to scatter, probably for this exact reason. Although, as I'm sure your funeral director told you, and I tell people, there's no ash police You know, no one's going to come screeching up in a vehicle and say, like, sir, we noticed there's a white film, you know, on the surface here. What have you been doing? So you're probably, you know, don't tell him I told you to do that. But
well, that's what my funeral director told me. He says, don't, yeah, you know, mention no names if you get
caught. Exactly. You didn't get them cremated here. But if you go offshore and you scatter, however, depending on how far, you know, 3 miles or whatever it is, how far you're supposed to scatter. When you first scatter, you can see the person's outline on the surface.
Yeah.
And then it sort of slowly sinks and dissolves. And it can be, it's quite lovely. I think it's a scattering can be a really lovely thing. And for some people, the clandestine element of not doing it quite legally kind of adds to the fun.
I hate to say
depending on who the dead person was.
Yeah, well, it was my mother. Who was fairly irascible, and the whole thing sort of took on a caper like thing. Like we went to two different places and definitely scattered and ran.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and for many people, that's an honor to their mother or their father who was kind of like that, or you know, whatever it is. Like, and that's why I think that maybe the rules around scattering are actually kind of work for the people who follow them and for the people who don't follow them.
Yeah. I mean, the ashes that you get are completely sterile.
Exactly.
There's no DNA in there whatsoever. Why can't you just scatter ashes whither you will? Are they worried that people are just going to put them like in all sorts of weird places?
They're worried that, so for example, this was maybe a year ago, somebody scattered ashes in the orchestra pit of the Met, the Metropolitan Opera. I think it was the Met. It was some big, you know, storied New York institution.
Okay.
And they had to evacuate the building because they thought it was anthrax. They didn't know what it was.
Oh, my God.
And they already have problems with people scattering ashes at Disneyland and Dodger Stadium and all of these iconic places. And every time there's ashes scattered, they have to close it down and clean it up. Because, yes, they're completely sterile, but I think that the public is not quite ready to sit next to someone's grandfather's ashes in a pile, you know, at their concert or their, you know, wherever they are.
And while we're on cremation, you finally, and I'm so glad you did this, you sort of answered the internet meme that's going on that people are saying, like, when I find out I'm going to die, I'm just going to eat a pound of popcorn kernels so that when they cremate me, it's going to be this huge Jiffy Pop sort of experience. And that's just been one of those things. You know, I haven't had the time or the will to try to answer that when I come across it, but thank God you did. That's not going to work, is it? Just to be straight line you.
It is not. And, you know, I love that you said that. I didn't have the time to answer it. Nobody has the time to answer that. Nobody is actually.
I know. And I love the fact that you did that.
Except,
thank you.
Except me. And it was actually, there are strangely really high level scientists doing research on popcorn and like the level at which it pops and the heat and the pressure that it requires to pop.
I want that job.
Basically, we already know this about popcorn. It has to be pretty ideal in order to pop.
Right.
You know, you're going to have all these old burnt or unburnt kernels at the bottom, unless it's absolutely perfect. So what's not absolutely perfect is sitting in the cold, damp, compressed environment of your stomach and then being exposed to a 1800 degree blast furnace.
Yikes.
You know, neither of those things is anywhere near ideal popcorn popping situation. So I would venture to say that not a single one will pop. They're just going to be blasted out of existence.
And as you say in your essay, and very correctly, if you're on your deathbed, genuinely on your deathbed, you're not going to be sitting there shoveling unchewed popcorn kernels down your mouth.
People generally overestimate how rascally they're going to feel at the very end of their death. People will say, you know, the questions that they ask in this book about Viking funerals or about dad's skull, these are questions that I get all the time, honestly, in a hypothetical sense. But when it comes to the family that actually comes into the funeral home, that's not usually their first request.
No.
You know, unless it's something that's been planned for years, people tend to skew more traditional when
that's
the time actually comes.
That's interesting.
And traditional doesn't have to mean embalming and burial and the whole works, but I mean that they're not trying to like really enact something whimsical unless they've planned for it ahead of time. So to think that you're going to be dying of colon cancer with your wife, loving wife next to you, and you're going to be like, put in the popcorn kernels, probably not going to happen.
Yeah, not at all. And this brings me up to the and I can't explain why, the chapter, the idea of this just sort of freaked me out. Somebody dies on an airplane. I was surprised to find out that they don't have any like spare room in which to put a corpse in case in mid-Pacific, as you're winging your way to Australia, somebody dies. The chances may be that you're going to end up sitting next to them on the entire flight over to Perth.
That is true. Yes, there was one Singapore Airlines for a brief period of time had something called the corpse cupboard on their plane, which was exactly what it sounds like, a place to store a dead body. And but beyond that, we know how little room there is. We know how much they pack us in like sardines in a modern plane and try and get every inch out of the plane, which means if someone dies, there's not extra room to put them. In the best case scenario, you know, maybe the flight attendants could put them in the back galley and cover them up, but then they're not secured in the event of turbulence or the bumpy landing. So which could cause even more problems. So they want them to be safe and secured. And the only place they really have to make sure they're safe and secured is strapped into a seat. But if there are no seats because it's a completely full flight, which most airlines aim for these days, it means that somebody is sitting next to a dead body.
Do they refund your ticket price if that happens? That's what
I would hope so. I didn't directly research that, but actually I'm interested in that now. If your seatmate dies, yeah, you think there are problems you can have on a flight, but that I think that's one that's outside of the normal realm of things we should expect.
Although, and justifiably so, you said personally that you would rather that than a really noisy kid or baby.
Yeah, I mean, but that's me. You know, it's
well, that's me too. I think it's a lot of other people. The only thing that worries me, and you learn a lot about this in your book, after a person dies, there's all sorts of stuff that's going on inside the body, and sometimes outside the body too, that could go on. So there could be noises and all sorts of smelly stuff happening, you know, in the remaining 5 hours of the flight.
Probably, I mean, in that amount of time, probably not, because there's no way, you know, if you were on a 18-hour flight and they took off and they're like, no, we're not going to land anywhere, we're just going to keep going on this 18-hour flight. Yeah, by the time the person landed, if they weren't kept, you know, if they didn't put ice packs around them or put them in the beverage cart or whatever they could do to keep them cool, yeah, there might be some issues with and it's wrong that the body is not immediately decomposing. Yes, there are subtle decomposition things happening inside the body,
right.
And that will continue happening for days, weeks after the person dies, but they're not immediately decomposing. They're not immediately bloating. They're not immediately smelling. It really is you probably have at least 12 to 24 hours before you have to do much at all to try and slow down the decomposition to keep them with you. So that's not the worst part. The worst part is just I'm already claustrophobic enough on a plane, and I happen to be comfortable with dead bodies. So I would be, you know, someday they may say, is there a mortician on board? And I will raise my hand with great gusto and say, I will sit next to the body. And this is something that I can do. But for most people, it's incredibly threatening to somebody die in this small, like you were saying, you know, it's scary to think of dying in an incredibly enclosed space with someone and then just have the reminder of our mortality sitting there strapped into their seat.
And your fear of flying anyways. So that sort of the reminder that we're all mortal is just really just sitting there as obvious as can be.
Exactly. And I really don't like flying, as many people don't.
Yeah.
And it took me a while. I thought it was being, you know, the turbulence, I didn't know what I thought it was, but it really is claustrophobia for me, the fact that I cannot get out and I cannot go anywhere, and cannot go anywhere, plus there's just corpses strapped in next to you. It has a Grand Junior sort of, you know, really, really darkness to it. But at the same time, most people who are dying up there, it's going to be a heart attack. It's going to be an incredibly natural death, probably unpreventable, you know, right, on ground or in air. And yeah, you just, it's, maybe it's an opportunity for everyone to learn a little more about the natural processes of death.
I could see that if you run that flight, you'd be there giving a lecture.
Yeah. I'm just like, hi everyone. I asked for the loudspeaker and I'm like, hello everyone. There has of course been a death, but here's why you shouldn't worry, man. That's my dream. An enclosed plane of people.
Captive audience.
A literal captive audience. A dead body, as an example.
I'll be signing copies of my book in the galley.
Exactly. Nowhere for them to go, but being forced to face their own mortality. Oh, perfect.
We just have 2 minutes left, and I just want to mention, you have an interesting chapter about cannibalism, which I don't want to go into. But the amazing thing is there's no laws against cannibalism, but there is the abuse of corpse laws. You can't just willy-nilly do strange things to a corpse.
No, and this is, abuse of corpse is something that I come back to many times in the book, because it really is the dream killer for all. And when people go, wait a second, why don't we X, Y, Z, any of the fantastical things that one could do with a dead body, it sort of always comes back to these abuse of corpse laws. I mean, even, dare I say, necrophilia is connected to abuse of corpse laws.
Because there can't be consent.
Exactly. So you can't. But even if there was consent, there are certain things that we don't do. So the laws are pretty boring in the sense that we're talking about, okay, here's what you're allowed to do. You're allowed to bury a body. You're allowed to cremate a body. You're allowed to donate that body to science.
Right, right.
And anything outside of that becomes incredibly difficult to do, because the idea behind the laws is that it's in the public interest to do one of those three things.
Well, we're going
to not go outside of that.
We're going to have to stop right there, because completely out of time. People are going to have to buy the book and understand what we're talking about vis-a-vis cannibalism and a lot of other things in the book. My returning guest tonight has been Caitlin Doty, author and mortician. And we've been talking about her latest book. It sounds, the title is great, but it's actually a great practical book to have in your house. Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Caitlin, it's a pleasure as always.
Thank you. See you on your next flight.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.